Hello, and welcome to WrestleSpective Radio. This is Jason Mann, and with me is a special guest, David from Divadirt, otherwise known as Mr. Glamazon. How are you doing today?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on the show.
No problem. Glad to have you. So, tell our listeners who might not be familiar with Divadirt what it's all about.
Sure. Well, Divadirt is a site, we call ourselves the Women's Wrestling Bible, and it's basically a site dedicated to the entire industry of women's wrestling, not just WWE. Certainly, we cover TNA, Shimmer, all the indie promotions, and a staff of about six or seven of us that really work hard to bring the full spectrum of women's wrestling, to the internet, and also not just to report the action in the ring, but to give our perspective and opinions on how we feel the direction of the industry is going.
And you host a live show on Wednesday nights?
That's right. Yeah, I host Diva Dirt Live Wednesday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. It's a
Okay.
call-in show for the readers of the site to call in, and it's been really successful in the sense that they really like interacting with us.
Okay. Great, great. So yeah, lots of interesting stuff going on there. And there are, obviously, women's wrestling in the United States kind of is an afterthought, at least in how it's presented on television. And kind of talk a little bit about what do you think of the state of women's wrestling, at least in the major league promotions today.
Right. Well, I think you could look at it in two ways. It really, there's Divas style wrestling and then there's women's wrestling. And in the WWE, they've really presented Divas style wrestling. Not just because they call them the Divas, but really what it is they're a complement, an auxiliary piece of the programming, if you will, to the men on their roster. And that's how they book them. That's how they present them on television. There's been some criticism that they just go for looks first and wrestling skills second. Although I don't think that's always true. I think the WWE women, a lot of them are very, very good in the ring. But the way they're presented on television is that they're not a main focus of the promotion. And I understand that. And no one at Diva Dirt thinks that they should be booked over John Cena. But the way they are booked on television in the WWE does not allow them to showcase their actual in-ring skills like you would see in a lot of the indie promotions. And I think that's the thing that's most disappointing to fans who like women's wrestling, is that you don't get to see on television the real quality wrestling that you see at some of these other promotions around the country.
Yeah, I can definitely I can definitely see that. And it's obviously the women's matches don't get a whole lot of time in WWE and TNA, and it feels like to me a lot of times they want to show off what they can do, and it ends up being where they kind of bam 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 hit a lot of high spots pretty quickly. And the psychology of the match is just because of the lack of time and kind of wanting to showcase things. There's some weaknesses there, unfortunately. In TNA, obviously the women's division was a pretty a strong showcase. Both the matches got some time, and definitely they were drawing some of the big ratings in the Awesome Kong and Gail Kim, especially. But kind of it sort of obviously changed in a little bit. What do you think as far as how it is in TNA?
Well, that's a great question, especially because we've seen some new hires there with Mickie James coming in, and word coming out that they've brought in Kaylee Burchill. Gail Kim's a great example of what I was saying earlier. Here she comes back to the WWE, and just has all the talent in the world, and I don't remember a real quality match that we've seen from her in the past year, which is really a shame because I think she can really go. In my problem with TNA is I just don't see them as real competition, for the long run, and that in general hurts the business. And because I'm tired of watching Sting. I'm just all the old WCW guys, and I've kind of tuned them out because of some of the people they've brought in that have kind of gone back to some of their WCW roots. I don't watch their knockouts as much because I don't like the programming. But I know a lot of the folks at Diva Dirt really do like some of the performers on that roster, Hamada, and you mentioned Awesome Kong and ODB. There's some real talent that was there now or was there. And I don't know, Jason, do you like the Beautiful People?
Well, not like a whole lot. I didn't watch them. I didn't watch TNA quite as much in kind of in their heyday when, that act was first pretty hot. I kind of caught on to it. I watched it more kind of later when it kind of cooled down a little bit. I think Velvet Sky really has something. I mean, obviously she's, a very attractive woman, but she's also, I think there's like a certain charisma and just a certain, star quality that she has. Angelina Love, has not really impressed me. I don't know. There's something about her. I think the biggest problem I have with the women's division in TNA is just the horrible, like, way they're all kind of presented as kind of shrewish, and they're all, they swear at each other all the time. They call each other whores and bitches, and it's not like I have a huge problem with, bad language, I'm not like I'm a, huge TVPG advocate, but I don't need it. Like, it doesn't need to be. It's like it's just being explicit for no reason. It's just because
Right.
it feels like there's, a huge amount of sexism that the writers are kind of working out, or whatever. It just, yeah, I don't, this doesn't seem like there's like a whole lot of respect for them as performers.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. But just because you raise your voice and call someone a bitch doesn't mean that's good programming. Or it
Right.
doesn't mean that that's like, you're being counterculture to what the WWE is presenting with their divas. No, I think you hit the nail on the head. One thing I do like about the Beautiful People, though, and the reason I asked you that question was I like the consistency they bring to the show. I mean, one of my problems with the way that WWE books a lot of their divas is that one week, Eve will be the girl of the moment. And the next week it's Alicia Fox. And then they're squashing them 2 weeks later on TV. They don't have a lot of consistency in their storylines outside of Lay Cool, who has been a really good storyline from the past year. And conversely, in TNA, I think the Beautiful People have been interesting. They've mixed them up with the members of the group and they've kept them there at the top of the title picture. I like the Beautiful People. I think they can have a good program with Mickie James. And to me, that will get me, tuning back in and giving them maybe another chance.
Sure. That makes sense. Yeah, I think, at least you're definitely, they're at the top of the hierarchy, and other than Lay Cool, there is not really anyone, equivalent in WWE. And it feels like they trade that Divas title, and of course, there were two titles now, just the one Divas title. Seems like they trade that an awful lot, and there's not really like a good chance at getting momentum behind, one person. Although it seems like finally, the well, I guess Lay Cool has had, they had the Divas title now, and they had the women's title before, so they've had it for quite a while. I kind of could see them building to a breakup in a WrestleMania match between the two. Do you kind of see them going in that direction at all, or do you think they'll just kind of, have babyface keep chasing them, and build to a, build to a big babyface conquering them?
Yeah, well, they have to break up eventually, and I think there's a good storyline that they could play there. And they've been a great part of the Divas division this past year. I mean, it's funny you mentioned, do I see them working towards a WrestleMania match? And the answer there is no, because we've got to get every girl on the show. For some reason, there's this belief that at WrestleMania, everyone deserves to work the show. I'm not a Brontosaurus, but I grew up in the 80s, and I mean, first of all, we've already seen more title changes in 2010 than I saw in like in 5 years in the 80s. It used to be a big deal when titles changed. Now, they're passed around, like jujifruits. But the thing is, at WrestleMania, it used to be that if you were on that show, that was a big match, and it was really, really a kind of a tip of the cap to the work you have done. And that you are an important part of the roster. Now it seems to be the belief that, well, we want everyone to get a nice paycheck. So we're not going to have Beth Phoenix versus Natalya for the women's title, which would be great, or Michelle versus Layla, which has been building now for you. We're going to have an eight divas match with like three guest referees and a bunch of lumberjills, just so everyone gets on the show.
Yeah, and it'll get 6 minutes too.
And they'll get to, yeah. Well, Undertaker's got to take 14 minutes to get to the ring.
Sure.
Yeah. So no, and I think that's diminished WrestleMania. That's maybe a different discussion, but to me it used to be that WrestleMania was, oh my God, Hulk Hogan and Randy Savage, they hate each other. They've been feuding for a year. We're going to see this big payoff. I really think WrestleMania now is no more important than the next pay-per-view in April that they have 3 weeks later. I mean, they continuously are working towards getting your money for the next show. So unfortunately, I don't think we're building towards a big payout there at WrestleMania 27.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that would, yeah, you make a good point. I mean, I kind of think it feels like the story would naturally kind of head that way, but
right.
You're right. The tendency to avoid doing women's singles matches, you know, on WrestleMania, or you know, kind of, I mean, it's not just with the women. Obviously, you know, there are other matches, you know, they usually throw in a battle royal or, you know, random, you know, obviously Money in the Bank used to be a way to get a lot of guys involved. So, you know, they probably aren't going to have it this year if they have the pay-per-view. But so, yeah, you're right. It does seem like there is a lack of, I mean, you know, there was a time, you know, especially in the early days of WrestleMania where they would, you know, I mean, obviously they built to a few big matches, but there were also kind of, you know, random matches, at least through the first six or seven WrestleManias as well, that, you know, that were kind of part of the storyline, but weren't necessarily, you know, like you would think of like as marquee matches. But there
Here's a great example. Right before the Hulk Hogan Andre the Giant main event at WrestleMania 3, do you remember the tag match right before that?
Was that the Killer Bees and Sheik and Volkov?
Yeah, the Killer Bees versus Sheik and Volkov. I mean, you talk about a bathroom break, you know, at WrestleMania. So you're right. I mean, the memory, you always remember back to, like, the big spots, like the Savage, you know, Steamboat, brilliant Intercontinental title match, or,
sure,
you know, the retirement of Roddy Piper or something like that. And WrestleMania 3 is regarded as a great show. There were certainly its share of holes as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, but the thing is, like, the big matches were, I mean, they obviously were built to for a long time, and there was a sense of finality. Although they went back to Hogan, Andre later, but it took, you know, it took 6 months, and it was, you know, historic events, and it, you know, it was a huge deal. I mean, that was, yep, you know, they weren't going back to Hogan and Andre the next month, and they weren't,
right,
you know, expecting all those feuds to continue. I mean, it seems like things ended and things began at WrestleMania, and there is not nearly that sense of that anymore.
Right.
So, yeah, kind of talking, this is actually a good transition to, you know, one thing we like to do here is when we have guests is just kind of talk about their, you know, how they got into wrestling, because everyone kind of got in at a different time. So talk about your first memories and how you got interested in wrestling.
Well, I was pretty lucky. I grew up in York, Pennsylvania, and not too far from the Hershey Park Arena. And a friend of mine had an extra ticket and dragged me along to a taping of Saturday Night's Main Event, which was in October of 1985. And you know, I was fortunate in this sense, because going to a taping of a big show for your first event really drew me in. You know, the crowd was hot, it was sold out. Hogan was on the card. It was a good show. Hogan and Andre versus Stud and Bundy was the main event, but the Macho Man was there. And I don't know if you remember that show. It was when the Junkyard Dog branded Jimmy Hart in the middle of the ring.
Yeah.
And it just seemed – I remember loving the pageantry. I remember loving the, you know, everything, the music when they came to the ring, the, you know, the showmanship in the ring, the reaction of the crowd. It was just unlike anything I had ever seen before. I had watched it a little bit on television, but being there in person at a show where Hulk Hogan, you know, brought the roof down, and it made a really, really big impact on me. Now, over the course of the next 6-7 years, I was just really wrapped up in it, and you know, that's why I didn't have a girlfriend in high school. But living near the Hershey Park Arena was interesting, because they would have the monthly house shows come around, and then they would have occasional tapings of Saturday Night's Main Event. Of course, we didn't have all the pay-per-views we have now. But growing up, you know, in that rock and wrestle connection, then when Hogan just exploded on the scene, it really made a big impact on me. I did not follow WCW that much. It stuck mostly with WWF at the time, now E, and that's really how I got into it. I mean, throughout, you know, since 1985, there have been periods of time where I've been less involved or followed it, you know, kind of on the periphery, you know, reading results on the internet or whatever. And simply because life overtakes you. I got married, you know, I had kids, and, you know, my wife's not crazy if I, you know, dedicate a lot of time to sports entertainment instead of mowing the lawn. You know what I mean?
Sure, sure. Funny thing, we just did a podcast that reviewed that Hogan, Andre, and Stud Bundy match, you know, just randomly a few shows ago. So, which is a terrific little match, and the crowd was, you know, incredibly electric for it. It was, it's pretty fun. Actually, I have a pretty similar background as far as time frame goes. I got into it. I was about like 86. Really, really in 87. I became a huge fan, and I've kind of also gone in and out. Kind of the mid 90s kind of faded out, and then kind of got back in during the Monday Night Wars. That was those 80s. That time was just such an electric, fun time in wrestling, and there were, so many great places where wrestling was going on, and I wasn't aware of most of it, and didn't appreciate most of it at the time. Learning about it later, and thankfully, with DVDs that are released and YouTube, kind of rediscovered a lot of, time periods and a lot of, areas that I, didn't know about at the time. But definitely a huge WWF fan, and I loved, Savage and Strike Force and Hart Foundation, and of course Hogan and all those guys, fantastic times.
Well, and I wasn't smartened up at all at that point. And I gotta be honest with you. When I watched WrestleMania 3, I mean, the Hart Foundation will never be topped for me. I was just in love with the pink and black, and my buddy and I would, we dressed up them for Halloween, and when they were World Tag Team Champions, it was really important to me. And look, I was, screw it, I was 14. I'm not making apologies for it. Mm-hmm. If you would have told me at WrestleMania 3, when they faced the Bulldogs and Tito Santana, that they were like related to each other and actually friends off camera, I would have spontaneously combusted.
Yeah. Yeah.
I couldn't handle that. Like, if you just told me that, the British Bulldog was related, like, what? I just couldn't have handled it.
Yeah, that was, I was the same way. I mean, I would not have been able to, my brain would not have wrapped around that, either. I had a friend who was a little bit older than me who kind of, kind of shared some of like the insider stuff. Like, he told me that like Vince, was the, owner of WWF, and, and he told me, some of the things like that, that, were, I guess, relatively easy to find out. But, still, yeah, it's funny the extent of which, kind of ignorance is bliss in a way, where, you just kind of enjoy it more when you don't know as much about it, but then when you kind of like start discovering the secrets, it becomes like, it feeds the thirst for more knowledge. It's weird how that works.
Well, that's a great point. And I think a modern reference to that is Michelle McCool, because I to turn back to the women's wrestling, I love her, and she is, I think she's talented in the ring. I think she's made a nice transition from when she broke into the business to where she is now. And, it's such a shame, in my opinion, that people continuously come back to her relationship with The Undertaker, now married to him. And I'm not going to be naive. I'm not going to say that has nothing to do with where she is. But I think it's a real detriment to her that people say that, because she can hold her own in the ring. And I think it's worked to get much better on the microphone. But it's like it always comes back to that.
Yeah. People do say some pretty nasty things about her, I've noticed, and I don't understand. I mean, I don't think her, her push is, significantly above, or really anywhere above, her talent. I mean, I think she's, she's perfectly good in the ring. The character, I think, works. I can understand some people who are a little tired of the Lay Cool act. I mean, I think, but it's meant to be annoying too. I mean, it's a heel act. It's meant to be something that, gets under people's skin, and you want, they are trying to be hated so that they, will cheer the baby faces who are, trying to dethrone them. So, there's obviously a fine line with that sometimes between, the kind of heat that you want and the kind of, the go away heat or whatever. But, I agree. I think that's kind of people are pretty ridiculous about, of course, probably her job and her push is certainly elevated by the fact that she's, with, married to the Undertaker. But it's not like, it's not like she's undeserving of it, or that, she's a bad performer, but, by any stretch.
Right. Well, here's the thing. I've been married 11 years. And let me tell you, it's not easy. I mean, it's this whole thing like, oh, she's married to the Undertaker, must be great. Being married in regular life has its ups and downs. I can't even imagine being married on the road all the time with the stress and pressure of that industry. And that's not, let's be fair. There's every person in the WWE, there's 10,000 people that would take that job if they could.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a high profile gig. And, you know, to be on the road and with your husband all the time, I mean, it's funny how people say, well, that makes it so easy for her. I think if you're married, you understand that can make it actually very challenging. And it's not like Michelle McCool couldn't find another dude. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, so, I mean, anyway, but I will say this about her. I've had the fortune of meeting most of the WWE divas in person. Mm-hmm. And aside from my love for Beth, so that colors my opinion, Michelle McCool is absolutely stunning in person. You know, and just you can't take your eyes off her. And she's almost breathtaking. You know, she's not as affable and as friendly as like Natalia, Layla, who is just one of the sweetest people you will ever meet your whole life. I mean, and the great thing about Layla is she has time for everybody. I mean, you know, whether it's a child or someone in a wheelchair. I mean, she does. I mean, the WWE does a great job in reaching out to, like, you know, the underprivileged and the people that are really struggling. That, you know, of course, we know with Make-A-Wish Foundation, but I've seen Layla personally just be the sweetest person you could ever meet to everybody, and I really respect that. I respect anybody who, you know, in a high-profile job like that, because they should do it, but we all know that they get jaded a bit over time. Michelle McCool is a little bit cooler, a little bit more standoffish, not as friendly maybe as some of those others, but is absolutely – I mean, she's pleasant, but she's absolutely striking in person.
Yeah, and yeah, certainly some people just are better at you know, being comfortable in crowds or being comfortable with people, you know, who are strangers or they don't know well. So, yeah, that's certainly not an indictment on her, you know, on anything of her, you know. Some people are just a little more outgoing than other people are.
Right.
So, yeah. So it says you thankfully gave me a few notes on kind of your background. So in kind of, you know, your evolution as a fan, you've been to 4 WrestleManias. It's pretty impressive.
Well, yeah, I went to WrestleMania 4 and 5 in Atlantic City, which was, you know, let me tell you, back in the when I was growing up, monumental milestones in my life. My friend and I, we begged and pleaded and begged and pleaded, and finally our parents took us down Atlantic City, about a 3-4 hour drive from where we grew up. Mm-hmm. And you know, just like I said, real milestones. I mean, at the time, I you know, WrestleMania was enormous for me personally. They were great experiences. I shared them with good friends of mine, and it was really special. I went to WrestleMania 25 down in Houston with the same guy who's still a very, very good friend of mine that I went to those other WrestleManias with. So we make it a yearly tradition now. You know, life has certainly changed. This is our one chance a year to get out with you know, have some guy time and you know, kind of reminisce about growing up together and being fans. So it's a lot of fun.
Sure. And I guess you know, since obviously you you know, obviously you're with Diva Dirt, specializing in women's wrestling, you know, talk about, obviously, you know, women's wrestling has evolved quite a bit, you know, since the 80s. I mean, in the 80s you kind of had the fabulous Moolah matches with, you know, a lot of, you know, hair assisted snapmares and you know, that kind of style. I mean, it was definitely, I don't know, a little bit more of just a kind of a basic fundamental style. I mean, you had some pretty good workers then, you know, Judy Martin, for example. You know, you definitely had, of course, the Jumping Bomb Angels and Glamour Girls series, which was really my first exposure to, you know, any women's wrestling that you know, was really, you know, for lack of a better term, any good, you know. Yeah. I mean, were you really into women's wrestling at that point, or did you get into it later?
Well, you know, it's funny you mentioned that series. I was a little confused by it, to be honest, because, you know, all of a sudden Jimmy Hart wasn't he managing the Glamour Girls?
He did, yeah.
Right. You know, so it's like all of a sudden they were on TV and they were the women's tag team champions. I didn't quite understand why all of a sudden that became, you know, that was something that they showed us on TV, or why Jimmy Hart got involved. But I did like the matches. And my favorite back then in general, though, was Sherry Martel. Mm-hmm. Just I loved not only her talent in the ring, but how great she was as a manager and how great she was on the mic. I was really drawn to her because of her overall skill set. I think she would have been successful in any era. Whereas now, you know, I am absolutely, even to this day, in love with Miss Elizabeth, and one of the first girls I ever had a crush on in my whole life. But I'm not sure she'd be as successful today as was back then.
Well, they certainly wouldn't have the patience to develop the relationship between her and Savage, you know, spending, you know, basically, you know, 3.5 years, you know, building to, or well, actually more like 4 years, building to, you know, first, obviously, the babyface turn, and then building to the Hogan feud and the betrayal, and then, you know, another couple years, and then, you know, obviously going back to that emotional moment at, you know, WrestleMania 7. So, you know, yeah, I you know, obviously, you know, she was stunning, and, you know, she was good in her role, but there's no way that, you know, that anyone would invest in a 7-year storyline between two people that, you know, basically made sense and didn't involve, you know, 700 turns during, you know, during that time.
Right.
So, yeah, obviously it's hard era to compare, but yeah, I definitely agree. You know, Sherry Martel would have worked. I mean, she, in any era, she was just so, you know, incredibly, you know, charismatic, and, you know, she was a good worker too. I mean, you know, she had some great matches, obviously, you know, in her WWF stint and in AWA, and, you know, really had, you know, really was, you know, she was younger and, you know, more athletic, and, you know, and could really, you know, do some good stuff.
Well, Jason, you know, it's interesting you mentioned, though, about how the style of the matches was different back then. But, you know, you go back and watch a lot of those old DVDs. A lot of the men's matches were like that too, right?
Sure. Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, obviously the style of wrestling in general was, you know, was very different.
Right, right. And so, you know, I mean, it's funny how you know, Randy Savage's flying elbow was jaw-dropping, and it was, oh my God, you know, what a great finisher. And now, you know we see people do those kind of moves all the time, like right at the beginning of the match. I mean, it's just become different. Not that one is necessarily better than the other, but certainly the pace of the women's matches back then were different, and I think that was true across the industry.
Yeah, well, I mean, that was one interesting thing about the Glamour Girls Jumping Bomb Angels series, I mean, which is really influential for me, because, I mean, the Angels were just doing moves that, you know, even the men weren't doing, and, you know, they were doing power bombs, and they were, you know, picking up the, you know, the Glamour Girls, who were quite a bit heavier, and, you know, and, you know, just doing a whole bunch of cool high flying stuff. And it was really, I mean, they really did get, you know, pretty over based on, you know, just their in ring work, and without, you know, I mean, just, you know, they were at the Royal Rumble 88 special on USA, and, you know, they and the Survivor Series 87, they had a couple, you know, showcases on pay-per-view, but obviously it was very much in the, you know, the lower card, and it didn't, you know, it only had legs for about a year. But, you know, that was a, you know, that was a pretty incredible, you know, fun series, and really, you know, way ahead of its time, you know, for what was going on in the United States, both men and women.
Well, I think that's the great point, because I had no idea at the time the influence that, you know, Japanese wrestling or, you know, like the Lucha Libre style. I didn't understand. I thought everybody wrestled like Junkyard Dog, you know?
Yeah.
And right. So, you know, I didn't appreciate the Jumping Bomb Angels like I should have, or like I would now.
Sure. Sure. Yeah. And obviously, yeah. Well, thankfully not every wrestler wrestled like Junkyard Dog, because that would not be particularly fun. Not to, you know, not to make fun of Junkyard Dog too much. I mean, he did his thing, and that's fine. But yeah, that would not be good for everyone to wrestle like that, which, you know, I really think actually there's kind of something that's missing in wrestling today is, you know, especially in WWE, there really is a very strong WWE style, and there's very much a way that, you know, WWE matches are worked. And, it, you know, there's a main event type of match, and there's a mid-card type of match, and there's a women's type of match, and there's a tag team type of match. And, you know, they really do, you know, fit a formula. I mean, there's, you know, there's some small variations on there, but you really do not get, you know, like, I think the best type of wrestling, you know, like WWF in the late 80s and, you know, WCW in their strong years, is you get a real variety, you know, of different styles and different looks and different characters. And I do think that's, you know, missing to a degree, you know, in today's wrestling.
Yeah. You know, when I was growing up, I didn't understand the whole booking and how they put these shows together. I remember thinking, you know, why does Jake Roberts never get a title shot? Why does Roddy Piper, you know, until he won the Intercontinental title later, but, it, you know, for a long time, he didn't have any title shots. He didn't get any championships. I guess he had the championship matches with Hogan, but he never won. The point being, though, that Jake Roberts didn't need a championship to draw money, right?
Right.
Hacksaw Jim Duggan, all he needed was a board. Coco Beware needed a bird. They had their gimmicks. The title belts were used as kind of replacements for those kinds of gimmicks, right?
Sure.
And I didn't quite understand that, how they booked back then, and it didn't make any sense to me. And as I started to learn more and more, I said, oh, you know, what they're doing is putting together an entire show. And certain people, like the Honky Tonk Man, his matches now were important because he had the Intercontinental Championship. Jake Roberts, he can main event anywhere because of who he is. He doesn't – the title is wasted on him.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, or, you know, I mean, if he'd had it for a little while, I mean, I think it would have been fine. But, yeah, it wasn't – he didn't need it because he was already – you know, he had a great character and he was over and it would have – you know, it could have worked with him, you know, having a short reign, perhaps, you know, maybe in 87 or 88. But, you know, they obviously, you know, they had better candidates. And that talent pool was so deep then that,
right.
You know, there were, you know, you save the titles for the best of the best. And Jake Roberts, you know, was very close to the best of the best. But, you know, there were, you know, who would have you have not put it on instead of putting it on Jake Roberts? I mean, obviously, Savage, Steamboat, you know, Honky Tonk, you know, that character just fit. And Warrior was your rising star, and you
yep.
know, so yeah, I'm you know, it there wouldn't have been there, you know, there just wasn't a good opportunity for it, and yeah, and it certainly, you know, he had the snake, he had his character, you know, he didn't need to be a champion, he could kind of be in that, you know, in that mix, he could challenge for it, and you know, so you're absolutely right about that.
Well, and I think you mentioned an interesting point about the WWE style. Remember when they bought WCW and there was a whole invasion angle? And
I do remember that slightly, yes.
Yeah, I've tried to forget it personally. But I found it interesting when I read comments that some guys couldn't adjust to this. Even like the size of the ring was different, right?
Yeah, it was. Yeah, the WWE ring is obviously a little bigger.
And I just think that's crazy. I mean, I, you know, you know, if you're a good wrestler in WCW, what do you mean you can't adjust to the WWF style, WWE style, whatever? And so, but I found that interesting, and it, when you brought that up, it reminded me of that, how some guys can't make that that transition, and it really can't, they can't, you know, mold into that kind of style.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think that it also can be used as an excuse, you know, as... Like as a kind of an excuse for protecting, you know, your spot, or as a, you know, way of like limiting, you know, like, you know, just kind of like to justify like a narrow way of thinking, you know. I mean, obviously there are certain guys who just, you know, are used to a certain way and can't adjust. I mean, obviously the great workers, you know, can, you know, work any or at least most styles. And that's, you know, that kind of what separates a, you know, a really, you know, top level guy from somebody who's just, you know, pretty good and, you know, kind of fits their niche.
Don't you think we were robbed of what could have been maybe the greatest storyline of all time, though, the WCW invasion? I mean, you know, no disrespect to DDP and Booker T, but, you know, I mean, it wasn't like seeing Ric Flair and Sting invade WWE.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I think that, you know, there were a lot of, you know, just huge mistakes that were made to, you know, with that story. I mean, I think, you know, yeah, if they could do it over again with hindsight, I mean, they could have done it a lot better. I think they thought they didn't need those level of stars. I think they thought the name would be good enough. And, you know, once they kind of quickly realized that would be a problem, they kind of, you know, had to sort of do it all on the fly. And I, you know, obviously there was the, you know, the ECW, you know, influence getting involved. And I think that kind of, you know, that was an exciting one show angle to get ECW in the mix, but then that kind of diluted the whole idea. And, you know, I think, turning Austin the second time, I think was a huge mistake. I mean, I think the first one, you know, was a mistake, but, you know, at the time it wasn't obvious that it was a mistake. It wasn't really until, you know, a few months in where people didn't want to boo Austin and people were turned off by it. And I thought they kind of had a chance to kind of hit the reset button on that, handed to them, but they kind of stubbornly, you know, kind of stubbornly just, you know, didn't learn that lesson and decided, you know, what we're going to have him be a heel. And maybe, you know, I mean, Austin himself has admitted that, you know, he really wanted to be a heel and he really wanted to make it work. And, you know, he admitted that was, you know, obviously was a mistake. So maybe at that point he was still adamant for doing it. I don't know. But yeah, it definitely, Yeah, I mean, I think not bringing in the WCW stars, most of whom ended up working for the company later anyway, I'm sure, you know, it did save WWE some money and some egos for not doing that, but they, you know, left a lot of money on the table probably, for, well, almost certainly, they left a lot of money on the table by not being more careful with it, not treating WCW, you know, as a stronger entity. I mean, I think even if, you know, they basically had the talent they had, maybe adding a Flair or a Goldberg or, you know, just one more, you know, one or two more big level stars, that it probably could have worked if the WCW side had been portrayed, you know, as strong from the beginning. I mean, you know, look at what's happened with Nexus. I mean, Nexus, you know, they were nobodies and they were treated as jokes, you know, other than Wade Barrett to a degree, you know, throughout, you know, the entire NXT thing. And they do one hot angle, you know, in WWE, and you know they're main eventers, and you know they have, it hasn't exactly drawn, you know, huge numbers, but I mean they, you know, it's not like it's been a huge failure either, and they're still, you know, obviously they're, you know, having a pretty strong storyline with John Cena even now.
Oh yeah, no, I think that the NXT storyline with Cena has been fantastic. If for no other reason that it, you know, I know that it's going to continue each Monday night. I mean, with WWE, you know, one Monday to the next, you never know. It's been a nice, consistent storyline, and you're exactly right. It's elevated some guys that, you know, 6-8 months ago I didn't think would be in this position. But I go back to, you know, when you talk about bringing in Flair, bringing Goldberg. I remember, wasn't Ric Flair supposed to headline WrestleMania 8 with Hulk Hogan, but they couldn't, one wouldn't lay down for the other?
My understanding of that is that the situation was they did the Flair Hogan house show series, you know, right when Flair debuted, and it did fine at first, and then kind of faded a little bit, and then they, WWF made the choice of Vince made the choice not to go with it at WrestleMania and kind of go in a little bit of a different direction. And Flair kind of cooled off after a few months there, although he did, you know, when he won the Royal Rumble match, he definitely, you know, heated back up. But I mean, given the situation with, you know, Hogan, you know, that being a match where, you know, he was set to, you know, it was teased that it would be his last match and that he would retire, or certainly he wasn't coming back for a while. You know, I don't think Flair and Hogan, you know, I just don't think that dynamic would have worked as well given the circumstances of Hogan leaving, because, you know, you can't have their final match have, you know, Flair win, and, you know, Hogan winning, you know, beating the champion doesn't make sense either. So, you know, probably the way that they did it kind of worked out. Plus, you know, as silly as it sounds, I mean, there were still a lot of hope that Sid would really turn into, you know, a huge star at the time. And, you know, he was, you know, that Hogan Sid in a way was kind of, you know, considered a dream match, although it, you know, clearly didn't work out like, you know, like it was hoped. And obviously we got a great Savage Flair thing out of it. So I think it was less egos and more just the, you know, obviously if Flair and Hogan had wrestled in 89, it would have been the biggest thing in the world, but you know, the business had kind of changed a bit and it wasn't nearly as hot, and, you know, kind of the perception of Flair and the perception of Hogan had changed a little bit, and it wasn't, you know, it was still a huge, it still would have been a huge thing if they'd done it at WrestleMania, I think. Like, I think they were, I'm not sure it was the best thing to lose faith in it, but I do think that they did have some justifiable reasons for not doing it.
Yeah, that's good perspective. I know, the reason I thought about it was because when they had this WCW invasion, I wonder, you know, did Goldberg not, you know, come on board, Flair not come on board, because these guys wouldn't lay down, you know. Because one of the things that ruined WCW at the end, in my opinion, was that, you know, the egos just ran rapid, and, you know, no one would lay down for anybody else, and so you had all these terrible endings, all these screw job endings. And I'd say that's one thing I always respect about Chris Jericho. I mean, the guy, you know, will help put other people over, and everyone knows how good he is anyway. But I, you know, some of those selfish attitudes, I just wondered if that was why that invasion didn't work better.
Well, yeah, obviously that was certainly, you know, a reason why they may have been reluctant to bring some of the WCW guys in, you know, particularly maybe Nash or, you know, Scott Steiner, who kind of had a bad reputation at the time, and, you know, some of the other guys who had some name value, but, Obviously, that had questions on attitude, especially at the time. Flair obviously was, someone who's never really had a problem putting anyone over. I think that, yeah, I think that was more just, I think most of it was financial, just, those contracts were huge and they didn't want to take on those contracts. And I think it was more they didn't want those guys to be paid significantly more than their top guys. At least, having, a lot more guaranteed money. I think that the economics of it played a larger role than the concerns of, guys maybe not, putting, being willing to put guys over. But obviously I wasn't in the locker room at the time or anything like that. I just, kind of based on what I've read and, over the years and what kind of makes sense. That's the conclusion I've come to.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the whole Time Warner AOL merger because of two reasons. First of all, basically that was the end of WCW, right? Because they didn't want to keep running a company like that, was losing money. And my wife was working for AOL at the time and lost her job.
Oh wow! Well, no, that wouldn't be good.
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks AOL. Thanks for laying off my wife and ruining my Monday night.
Wow.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, that's no fun. Well, yeah.
So we had a
baby. Yeah, obviously, yeah, that AOL, that didn't work out for anybody. But, yeah, it was sad. I think there were so many things that were wrong with WCW. I mean, obviously, the egos were a big part of it. Just, disaster of booking for, a couple of years. Having just such incredible talent and needing to make new stars and absolutely refusing to do it because you think that, the guys who are in their mid 40s and getting older are going to, last and be fresh forever when it's completely obvious in everyone's mind that, you need to bring in a mix of guys and you need fresh faces for those, for your stars to face or else, everything will stagnate, which is exactly what happened.
Right, right. It's funny you talk about, bringing guest stars in, what TNA is doing now with these Jersey Shore, J-WoW is now,
Yeah.
On the air, and maybe for one show it's fine, maybe for two shows it's fine, but there's no long-term viability here. They need to build their knockouts division around, someone like Mickey James and the Beautiful People, and then girls that will 2, 3, 4 years from now be stars and continue to carry the division. I have to be honest with you, Jason. If you'd have told me 2 years ago The Miz was going to be as big as he is in WWE, I never would have believed you.
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. But they've done a really good job building his character that if you told me he was going to be in one of the bigger matches at Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, whatever, I'd be okay with it. I'd enjoy watching him.
Yeah, he's really come along. And, yeah, he's an example of somebody that's, kind of been built slowly over the last couple of years. Really when he moved over to Raw at first and, kind of – it was thrown into something with Cena, without really, it was a much hotter thing than they expected. And I'm not sure they really knew how to handle it. And they were really reluctant to let him get any heat on Cena at all. Right. And then they, they had one, pretty strong Raw match where, Miz basically beat on Cena for, like 10, 15, 10, 12 straight minutes. And then, Cena, made the comeback and won at the end, but it kind of, made Miz look pretty good. But, kind of at the end of that feud, it was kind of clear that Miz wasn't on Cena's level, but they kind of, kept, churning along with Miz. And now obviously, he's a very strong character. He's a person that, that fans are willing to accept, in the main event. And I think, when he cashes in that Money the Bank and presumably wins the title, I think it's going to be obviously, a pretty big moment. I'm hopeful that they won't do it the way they've kept, doing it over the, with every Money in the Bank where it's like a sudden, okay, the champion is at a disadvantage. Now I'm going to cash it in. I kind of hope that he instead actually cashes it in advance, says, I want my shot at such and such date, and just kind of plays it off as I'm so confident that I'm so good that I'm willing to let you know in advance that I'm going to beat you, kind of thing.
Right, right.
I just think that could be like kind of a cool way, because I kind of think that the champion, the Money in the Bank guy cashing in out of nowhere on a random show, just that's kind of gotten played out.
It hasn't. It would be a shame because they've done a nice job with his character. And you're right. I don't want to see it play out that way, especially for him. But I got to tell you, I was at WrestleMania 25, and I did think that the HBK Undertaker match was among the best matches I've ever seen live. Certainly, you know, great match on television as well. But the crowd was so unbelievable for that match, and WrestleMania 26, in my opinion, didn't.
Oh, David, I lost you.
In my opinion, the only match out there for WWE at WrestleMania 27 that even approaches that is if The Undertaker faces, you know, John Cena if he flips to a heel. And as much crowd reaction as he gets now, to me, that is the money match for them. And I just can't believe they don't book that for 27.
Yeah, that kind of seems like a logical direction. And obviously, you know, Cena and Taker has been a match that, you know, has made sense, you know, in the last couple of years. Obviously, you know, the Shawn Taker series, once that became what it was, you know, made sense to do it when they did it. But, I don't know if it's the right time to turn Cena. I kind of go back and forth on that a little bit just because I think that he, I think he has a certain fan base that is there to see him, and that is their folk hero, and that if he turned, that those fans might, you know, be alienated and leave the product and make, you know, WWE even less popular than they are now. I mean, kind of what happened a little bit when Austin turned heel, mm-hmm. obviously on a smaller scale because, you know, wrestling was much more popular then and Austin was a bigger star, but Cena obviously is, you know, is the one guy who really does bring a different audience, you know, brings that younger audience and the women, you know, and, you know, I wasn't sure. I think that this Nexus storyline has kind of cemented that for me based on kind of the reactions of people, you know, really distraught about Cena being in Nexus. And, you know, I really see people really, you know, kind of passionately into this, and which, you know, isn't really as common today as, you know, as it used to be. And I think that I now kind of am leaning against it being, you know, Cena turning heel, or at least turning heel before the match. Like, I could definitely see, you know, them going in as baby faces and, mm-hmm. you know, maybe even Cena turning heel and winning and, you know, breaking that streak. And then, you know, then you can, you know, build to Taker getting his revenge, or, you know, or maybe, you know, Cena loses the match and that's kind of the impetus for him to turn, or, you know, there's a lot of different ways you can go with it, obviously. But I think you got the big point, though, I think you really got to be careful with that Cena heel thing. I mean, obviously there's a pretty big segment of the of fans who are sick of him, who are ready for a change with him, and are not emphatic about John Cena. But, you know, they're, most of those people are pretty staunch WWE fans who are going to stick with it, you know, through thick and thin. So it's difficult to, you know, it's a difficult choice, I think.
What I didn't realize growing up, when Hogan was at the top of every card, was his role really is like the dessert at a restaurant, right? Because no matter how bad the salad was or how bad the meal was, as long as you had a good banana split at the end, you went home thinking, man, I love that place.
Sure.
And you know, I didn't realize, you know, you can put birds and snakes and all kinds of, you know, other kinds of things on the card, and the heels can win their share of matches and screw job finishes. It doesn't matter. As long as Hulk Hogan drops the leg on Sika and retains his championship and poses in the ring for 5 minutes, the people think they had the time of their lives.
Yeah, definitely.
And that's right. And they will buy T-shirts. They will buy tickets the next month that you come to town. And Cena, and you're right. I mean, they got to be careful because he has become, in my opinion, the dessert of the company. That he is going to headline the shows, and when we leave to go to our car at the end of the night, we're going to think, boy, that John Cena, that was a lot of fun.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Although it's a dessert that's maybe not everybody likes, but it's still dessert. You're right, and it's,
well, the majority the majority of people must like it. I mean, you know, he's drawn money for the company. I tell you, I'm real hot and cold on The Undertaker. I thought WrestleMania 25 was great, obviously, but I saw him at one of the Access sessions that you know, and he was scheduled to appear not for photos and autographs, but just to come out in the middle of the ring and talk to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Jason, like, he came out with his slow walk, got in the ring, did his whole thing. He stayed in character the whole time, didn't take any questions from all the people that were there, told us how, you know, Shawn Michaels was going to rest in peace, and then just walked out. And, you know, it was like, come on, dude. I'm like, we're beyond this. I mean, in contrast to that, Cena was there the night before and came out. And I'll tell you what, he took some tough questions from people because, like we've talked about, he is not universally beloved. There are people that have very, very strong negative opinions of him. And people were vocal, catcalls, all kinds of stuff. And he stood right in there, kind of broke character and was just himself. And it's like, you know, I just am a little tired of, like, the taking 20 minutes to get to the ring and, you know, never letting The Undertaker see a different side of him, because we all know, come on, man, we all know the show now.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. You know, people talk about how protective he is of his character, and, you know, I can understand that to a certain extent. But at the same time, you know, you can YouTube, you know, him, you know, with an interview, you know, with Jimmy Kimmel back, you know, when he was doing the biker gimmick and him just being a normal guy. So it's like, well, you know, kind of the cat's out of the bag a little bit. You know, and I you know, it's a fine line because obviously, you know, you want, you know, when you have a character who's different like that, you do want to protect it to a certain extent. You don't want, you know, you don't want the Undertaker to be like laughing and joking and being, you know, because it does kind of ruin the magic maybe a little bit. But yeah, I kind of see it the other way too. It's like, well, you know, we're, you know, we understand that wrestling is entertainment, and that maybe there's a more, you know, there's, you know, maybe there's a, you, Undertaker can still maintain the character, but kind of, you know, engage people in a little bit of a deeper way.
Well, exactly. He doesn't have to come out and joke and laugh around. He can come out and stay in character to a degree. But, you know, it felt very impersonal. You know, every other star that was there that weekend was wonderful to everybody, you know. And you know, like I said, took questions from the crowd, good or bad, and just seemed to understand their role as a celebrity in that environment. And I was like, boy, O'Day, for someone who's been in this business as long as he has and does have people that love him unconditionally almost – I just felt like, you know, had I been there just to see The Undertaker, I'd have been very, very disappointed.
Yeah. Yeah. So you cut out for a minute. You were, or not really a minute, but for a few seconds, and you were talking a little bit about the, I think the 25 match compared to the 26 match. I mean, more the crowd, I guess. In what, just repeat that thought for you, because I think we missed just a little bit of what you said.
Sure. I thought that the setup and the way the match was booked for WrestleMania 25 was fantastic. The crowd was unbelievable. I mean, from start to finish, I've never seen a crowd in person that just stood the whole time and cheered. It was like a British soccer crowd or something, you know? It was really, really magical. A great, great, great match all the way through. I didn't see any need at all for the rematch, and I thought that was thrown together. It just didn't make any sense to me at all. I think it was the WWE saying, we don't know what the hell to do with these guys this year, and let's just put them back in a rematch. It didn't have that Hogan-Andre rematch feel like from WrestleMania 3 and 4. This felt just kind of like, well, you know, it worked once. It's a cheap way to get, you know, some more pub or press or whatever the second time around. Didn't work for me at all. Didn't see at all Shawn Michaels a chance to win that match. And it just fell very flat for me.
That's interesting. I actually really enjoyed the setup and the match itself. And I'm not even necessarily the biggest Shawn Michaels or Undertaker fan for that matter. But I really did. I actually thought the first match to me. Both matches great. The first one slightly a little more overrated. I mean, I hate to say that a great match is overrated, but there are a few things about it that, you know, a few psychology issues that I thought were, did a podcast about this a couple weeks ago, kind of comparing the two matches and, you know, basically both great. Just the first one, being slightly, I thought it was slightly better, or it was, you know, thought to be slightly better than it was. Although obviously when you're there live and that crowd, you know, being incredibly hot, I mean, there's, you know, that's a different experience than watching it on TV or on DVD. But And I thought the second match really held up. I really loved the story. I loved the finish. I loved, I've just, felt the emotion of, it being the end of Sean's career and kind of believed in that and kind of really, Sean in the last few years has really kind of changed my mind about him. I mean, I always appreciated him as a great wrestler and as a great performer, but just as, someone who I had much bigger emotional connection with at the end of his career than I ever did, during, his early years or his prime years. I really, kind of, capped that for me in a way. So it's interesting to hear your perspective on it. Obviously very different.
Yeah, I didn't care for the match, but I do agree with you that I did like the emotional send off, and I have a lot of respect for Sean, and I did like that part of it. And look, I have a lot of respect for the Undertaker, man. I can't believe, my God, I was in high school when this guy debuted in the WWF, and here I am 20 years later almost. I mean, I have a tremendous amount of respect for him for the longevity of the type of career that he's chosen. So I don't want that to come across any
Oh,
other
yeah.
way. I just was not looking, frankly, I was just not looking forward to seeing the match again. I thought the first one was great and the crowd was awesome for it, and I would have been fine if that had been the end of it.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's of course is perfectly valid. And one thing about Undertaker is I do really think that he's become really really has had a lot of strong matches at the end of his career, in the last few years, and really, developed a lot more versatility to his matches and doing different things and really having some great exciting matches. Obviously with a lot of great wrestlers, but also some that weren't necessarily all that great. Although the I haven't really seen much of at least match wise of the Kane feud, but those matches, I saw Kane and Undertaker wrestle plenty in, 98, 99. I don't ever really need to see it again.
Yeah. I agree with that. Although, they're another guy that I respect just for the fact that he's, still plugging along. I'm not ordering a pay-per-view now because they're at the top of the card.
Right, yeah. I mean, yeah, they're there. They have their role. That's fine. But yeah, I'm not watching matches with them, especially them together. I mean, they've done okay with the storyline. It's at least been kind of interesting, but silly, of course, in some spots. But yeah, it would take a lot for me to really want to see a Kane main event match where there's certain pairings with Taker that were, I can get excited about. But
Yeah, I totally agree.
yeah. Well, we, everybody who I talked to, I asked them to make a list of some matches, and we kind of chat about them. And the first match that you mentioned was from Bragging Rights in October of 2009, and it was Beth Phoenix, Natalya, and Michelle McCool against Gail Kim, Melina, and Kelly Kelly. So, why did you pick this match?
Yeah, well, obviously I'm a big Beth Phoenix fan, and my buddy and I had really good tickets. That show was out in Pittsburgh, and as it is with the Divas, they never tell you to like the weekend before or a couple days before the show whether there's even going to be a Divas match or who the match, who the participants are going to be. And I just had my fingers crossed for weeks that she was going to be on the show. There was certainly no guarantee, and it was announced fairly late that Raw versus SmackDown Divas match was going to be on the show, and then she got added to the team. Now, she had just switched over to SmackDown at the time, which I didn't sleep for about 2 nights because I was worried, oh my God, this is a demotion. She's leaving Raw. And I Jason, I'm not proud of this, but it was way over the top for me. But we climbed in the car and drove out to Pittsburgh for the Pittsburgh Penguins hockey game Saturday night. We stayed overnight and went to the Bragging Rights pay-per-view the next day, and it was the first time I had seen her wrestle in person outside of the WrestleMania 25 Divas Battle Royal, which we all know didn't happen. And then she ended up glam slamming Melina for the victory. And I know the people around me think I'm crazy because they're all ordering another soda and looking around, and I'm jumping around like my team just won the World Series. But it was special for me because it was the first time I'd ever seen her perform like that live.
Sure. Well, you know, now obviously, you know, now that we're talking about Beth in particular, what, you know, when did you first really, you know, learn about her? Was it in WWE or was it before that? And what, you know, what about her just, you know, compels you to be such a huge fan?
Well, you know, the story goes that, I mean, I was kind of in and out of WWE for a little while there because, you know, we had another kid, and like I said, life just got crazy. So I was bitching and moaning to my buddy about I didn't like the two brands, Raw, SmackDown. I didn't like the direction of the company. And he just looked at me and said, Dave, you got to get over it. You know, we've been fans our whole lives, just get over it. And that kind of, you know, slapped me in the face and was like, you know what? I'm going to have a better attitude about all this. And so I got more back into the WWE there in the summer of 2008. And I was watching, you know, we got together to watch SummerSlam, and that was her her match with Santino when they were Glamorella, and they were wrestling Mickie James and Kofi Kingston, and I think the winner took all. It was like, you know, Intercontinental Championship, Women's Championship.
Yep.
Yeah, and I was like, what is this? You know, I just didn't have the, I just wasn't back into it all the way yet. I didn't know what was going on, and it just seemed like a colossal waste of time. You know, and then I'm watching the match, I'm like, huh. She carried him out of the ring when she had both championships. That was kind of cool. And it just, I, you know, and then it was like over the next couple months, the whole Glamorella gimmick just worked for me. And I was very, very attracted. I think she's very, very pretty. But it was more than that because there's a lot of pretty girls in wrestling. And it was just, I loved her presence. I loved her character with Santino. I loved her when she was in the ring. And I don't know, you know, sometimes the light just clicks on, man. You just turn the switch. It's like, wow. I fell in love with her. I think she's fantastic. Everything about her.
Yeah, well, that I really enjoyed that the Beth and Santino relationship, and I felt like they kind of dropped that really almost out of nowhere. You know, didn't really seem to have like a very, you know, fun resolution. And they both kind of brought something out of each other that really, you know, was kind of fun and unique. And it just seems like it could have been something that you know, I mean, it was fun while it lasted, but it seems like it could have been something that even lasted longer and kind of even, you know, been like more of a, you know, a permanent memory. But yeah,
Real
definitely.
quick, and to that point, I think that it really hurt him more than her in some ways
That's
because
true.
I think he's been I'm not a big fan of his anymore. And I thought when they were together, his shtick was funnier, and you know, and when he was the Intercontinental Champion with the Honk-a-meter and all that kind of stuff, I bought him. I thought he was funny. He doesn't make me laugh at all like he used to.
Well, I think that's the difference between I think like there will be certain things that are really entertaining on their own that aren't necessarily, you know, either they're not scripted or they're not heavily scripted, you know, and then all of a sudden WWE realizes, hey, we've got something here. Now we need to have a segment every week involving this, and now we need to script out these segments. And I think, you know, Santino was just kind of naturally funny on his own doing his shtick, you know, and I'm not that I'm sure some of that was scripted out, and I'm sure some of that was, you know, I mean, you know, obviously the show was written, and I'm sure, you know, a lot of it, you know, was scripted, but it didn't feel like that. It felt like just kind of like naturally, okay, this guy's funny, and this guy's, it's not like he's being written into wacky situations. He's just making the wacky situations on his own by how he's acting. And then later he kind of just became like a guy who, you know, who would be thrown in, you know, and, you know, it was like a setup for a joke, and it's, you know, WWE level humor, which is hit or miss at best. You know, 'cause, you know, they're not expert. I mean, I guess some of them, you know, have a background in comedy writing, but there's not like, you know, their primary focus. And, you know, and not everybody there, you know, is a trained comedian or anything like that. Although, you know, Santino can be very funny. I still think he can be good, but, you know, yeah, it's, I mean, the act worked a lot better as a diluted heel than as a babyface too, I think. I think that's part of it, but I think just kind of like the, like another example of that is the whole damn thing with Ron Simmons. Where like I thought it was just it was always funny that, you know, Ron Simmons, you know, always like, you know, punctuated everything with the word damn, you know, back when, you know, he was doing the APA thing, and that would kind of always be like a funny thing he would do. But it wasn't like they pointed out, like, oh, he says damn, that, haha, that's hilarious. It's just kind of like a thing that, you know, if you watched a lot and you noticed would be enjoyable. And then suddenly, well, you know, oh, people respond to this and it's funny, let's make a big thing out of it. And then when you do that, you kind of ruin the joke a little bit.
Yeah, and to go back to Beth, I you never know when something, you know, is going to grab your attention or something's going to really be interesting to you. And when it started to be a realization to me that I really liked her character and I found her very pretty and all that, I couldn't believe how excited I would get for Monday night. You know, and it just, it came out of nowhere. Like, man, I really like WWE again, and I'm enjoying this, and my friend and I are, you know, talking about it, and it's a lot of fun, and I wonder what she's going to do. You know, it was just like, it just all of a sudden kind of crept up on me. Like, I hope she's on the show tonight. And I met her for the first time at WrestleMania 25 down in Houston. And it had she not been so lovely and such a wonderful person, I think I'd have been really hurt by it, you know, because I really like her, and she was great. And, you know, I've been very, very fortunate to have, you know, met her a few times, and just seems like a great person and someone I can truly say loves what she does and respects the business. I don't know, you know, I don't want to speak out of turn here. I don't know if we can say the same thing about Kelly. Kelly, she seems maybe that she was picked more because of how she looks, and this is a good paycheck for her. You know, I mean, look, she may love, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I think you can just tell there's a different level of dedication to, you know, the craft of wrestling when you're talking about Beth Phoenix and Kelly Kelly. Not that Kelly Kelly doesn't have her charm, so that she doesn't, you know, right, try to work hard, but yeah, there's a different level, certainly.
Oh, I mean, Beth, you know, told me her whole life she wanted to do this, and it was, you know, she had influences going back to Moolah and you know, Sherry and everything. So, you know, for her, it was an amazing achievement to have been where she was in the company, and I got a real respect for her journey to get there. So you know, the fact that I loved watching her perform and then getting to meet her a few times and seeing that she's, you know, really, really seems to be a great person was a great connection. And then, you know, I was fortunate that Extreme Rules 2010 was in Baltimore, not too far from where I live. And, you know, she, of course, won the women's championship that night. And that was, I'll tell you what, Jason, that just may never be topped.
Yeah, and I'd never seen that match. I got a chance to watch it. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a good version of the Bragging Rights match online, so I can't really say much about that. But I really did enjoy the work in this match. I really thought it was, you know, good. I thought they, you know, worked in, you know, the weapon spots very well. I had two minor quibbles with it. Well, actually, one was a pretty major quibble, which had nothing to do with their fault, but was the commentary that made it, basically took everything to be comedy, which, mm-hmm. which was sad. With Vicky, you know, Vicky being out in the corner and grabbing a broom, and then Lawler making, you know, the requisite witch joke or, you know, stuff like that, you know. Michelle McCool being given an iron, and then Michael Cole saying now they're really going to iron things out, you know, just kind of dumb stuff like that. And, you know, and I don't mind that during like a comedy match, but they were, you know, they were hitting each other, you know, I mean, they were having a pretty decent hardcore match. And, I kind of felt that was, I don't know if disrespectful is quite the right word, but, you know, it kind of reminded me there was a Nitro match, I think in 98 or 99, and it was, there were, you know, four luchadors. I think Halloween and Damien were two of them. I forget who the others, it might have been the Vianos or somebody, but the point is they were really like, they were having a really good, stiff, you know, hardcore match, and basically the announcers were, you know, treating it as comedy the entire time, and it just kind of like completely like showed a lack of appreciation for what they kind of were doing at that point, you know. And especially right. When you're talking about a match like this where it's, you know, it's very different from the title match they usually have, you know, and I was a little upset about that. The other thing was it seemed like there were some inconsistencies with the interference, like you know, it was like it was no DQ match, and so the heels sort of been like a, you know, able to interfere at any point. It seemed like they interfered when it was convenient to the story for them to interfere. Although they did do a nice, at least Beth did spray them in the eyes with at least Layla in the eyes with some hairspray. So at least Layla was taken out for a while, which made sense.
Right, right. And, you know, I wrote a column about this that I thought when I was driving home the night that it was the most perfect match I'd ever seen. And I'm not gonna lie to you. When Beth glam slammed her and won the match, I jumped around like a little kid. And I literally had people staring at me in my section, like, you know, like I belonged, you know, behind in glass at a zoo somewhere. But screw it, you know. I mean, I was pretty damn excited. And My problem, as I've had time to reflect on it, was first of all, was at Extreme Rules, which, you know, if you can tell me when that was, you know, people forget this wasn't WrestleMania, it wasn't the Royal Rumble. It was kind of a throwaway pay-per-view. Next year it'll be called something else kind of thing. Which was disappointing. The other thing, too, is, you know, Beth Phoenix and Michelle McCool are world-class workers. They don't need ironing boards. They don't need makeup. They could have had a tremendous one-on-one women's championship match. And I was just disappointed that those two workers weren't given the opportunity. Now, the other side of that is I love Layla, and I love Vicky as a performer. So for me personally, when we get back to my list here, you know, it was basically my favorite tag team of all time, Lay Cool, and my favorite women's wrestler of all time. So for me, you know... I was there to see it happen. It was really special.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, it's definitely, you know, I enjoyed the match. You know, it did get some time, you know, and had some good action. And, you know, and I thought, you know, everything they did looked pretty good. And, there was nothing botched or anything like that. And I thought Beth's celebration was, you know, it was a very nice low key, like, you know, satisfied, like, you know, I accomplished something big here and I'm happy to win this championship. And, and it's good times. Actually, before we get on to, we have a couple of old school, WWF matches to talk about. I just wanted to ask you, first of all, I guess, what's the latest on Beth's return? I is that supposed to be in the next few months, or have you heard anything about that? Or,
well, she had the surgery in May, and I had my ACL reconstructed in 2003, in February, and I can tell you from personal experience, I was not jogging until May. I was not running until October.
Okay.
Now the big difference here, of course, is, you know, I'm just trying to get back to, you know, so I can get the, you know, get the mail every day and go to work. You know, she's trying to get back to a world-class level and compete in the ring. So, you know, obviously the recoveries are different. But initially when she had the surgery in May, there were rumors that she could be back, you know, as early as like August, September. I was very skeptical of that just because, man, you know, she obviously is in great physical shape. She loves the gym, but the body only heals so fast. And, sure. Here we are now in October. I believe it'll be sometime December, turn of the year. I would think maybe sometime by Royal Rumble she'll be back in the storylines. And but I got to be honest. Melina came back from the same kind of injury, and I have a very, very hard time watching her in the ring. I'm telling you this: when you blow your knee out, you never forget the sound of it, you never forget the feel of it, and even after you are surgically repaired, it's always in your mind. If you go out for a run, if you play tennis, if you play golf, if you do anything, if you're putting presents under the Christmas tree, you know, it's something that you just never forget. And I remember the doctor saying to me, oh, you know, you know, we took the stitches out, blah, blah, blah. Your knee looks strong. You're good as new. You're never as good. The body does not forget. So every time Melina goes in the ring, I have a hard time watching it. And I'm curious as to what my reaction is going to be when Beth goes in. You know, whether it be December, whatever, it's going to take me a while to feel comfortable watching her just because it's a very personal type of injury for me.
Sure. And obviously with, with Melina, just depending so much on her flexibility, you know, that is kind of right. What she does. I mean, that's obviously, you know, even adds to that a little bit. And one other thing, since we're talking a little bit about, obviously we're talking about today's wrestling, we have Natalya, about to challenge for the Divas title at Bragging Rights on Sunday. And what are your thoughts on, you know, obviously, it's her first pay-per-view title shot, is that right?
No, she had a championship match at Night of Champions last month.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that's right. And it was a DQ. So, but okay. So, her second, but this is the first feud where she's had an opportunity for it anyway. So have they announced for sure whether it'll be Michelle again or whether it'll be Layla, or is that still to be determined?
I think it's still to be determined. The last I heard, now you used an interesting word there, a feud, because, part of my problem with the way these girls are booked sometimes is, you know, Alicia Fox towards the end of the summer was Divas champion and looked like she was going to be kind of a go-to girl for the next 6-8 months. Eve was, you know, before that, Eve looked like she was going to be someone that they were going to build around. I really, really, really hope that Natty isn't spiked like that, where they give her one more shot, she loses, and then, you know, 2 weeks later, she's on Superstars on Thursday night against the Bella Twin. I think this girl, can carry this division for a long, long time. And I've had the pleasure of meeting her. She is sensational, just a really, really warm, nice person. And you know, as a big Hart Foundation fan, it was a real thrill for me to meet her. And you get the sense, again, kind of like Beth Phoenix, that she really respects this industry. Obviously, it's in her family. And I think that you sense that as a wrestler from her. She seems to be powerful in the ring and someone that I would really like to see that belt around for a long, long time.
Yeah, it'll be, you know, interesting to see. And you know, obviously she's, you know, shown, you know, quite a bit in the time that she's had, you know, as a performer. And, you know, I think that could be a, you know, pretty strong match. It looks like it's going to be, you know, there aren't going to be too many matches on the card. I suppose they could always add some. So it'd be nice if, you know, maybe they got a couple extra minutes, you know, more than some of the other Divas matches, especially, you know, when you consider, you know, Natalya's level of work and if it's Michelle. Yeah, though I think Layla's, you know, pretty strong performer in the ring too. So I think either, you know, one of those could have a decent, you know, 8 to 10 minute match, maybe, you know, if, you know, if things went well and, you know, hopefully it does. Yeah. I don't know. You know, I mean, it would be nice to see, Natalya get a chance to win the title. Although, you know, I do think there's some merit in keeping Laycool strong, you know, for maybe for a little while longer, you know, maybe till Beth comes back, or maybe, you know, if you, like you said, if you're setting up the breakup, or, you know, if they're, you know, if they're both battling over the, you know, the kind of the idea that they both have a claim to the titles and, you know, they're going to feud over that or whatever. I mean, there's a lot of different directions you could go with it, but,
Well, and also, you know, you mentioned Layla, and I think she's a really interesting case because she has certainly improved as a wrestler, and she's improved as a character. And what I find so interesting is when we talk about Maryse, who, in my opinion, is an A-plus world-class character, someone that they could do an awful lot with. My interest in her is she ever going to get really, really good in the ring? Because I don't know if we've seen any growth from her as a wrestler, and that concerns me. We talked about, you know, Kelly and, you know, her motivation for being in this profession. To me, Maryse is a performer, an entertainer, a model, a designer. You know, is she like Natalya, you know, a wrestler?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, that is, you know, there is I agree that, you know, that question is yet to be answered. That's for sure. So let's we talked about you know, speaking of course, you know, just of Natalya, and you know, and obviously the Hart family, that leads us nicely into our next match, the Hart Foundation against Strikeforce, which was the tag title change in November of 1987. And this is a match that's near and dear to my heart because I was a huge, I mean, I love the Hart Foundation, especially later, but I was a huge Strikeforce fan. And I actually taped this match on TV. It aired on Superstars. And yep. I still have the original cassette tape that I, that from when I taped this, you know, 23 years ago.
Boo! Actually, burn it! I know. I mean, that's great. But first of all, I think it's awesome. You still have it. That's pretty cool. You know, I can only say that, you know, I was 14, and the WWF at the time was a really, really big part of my life. I will never like any tag team or any wrestler better than the Hart Foundation back then. And I remember they announced it, I believe the week before, that they were going to wrestle Strikeforce the next Saturday or whatever for the tag team championship. And I just remember having a pit in my stomach thinking, this is it. And they'd had the titles for a good amount of time since January of that year.
Yeah.
I haven't cried many times over a wrestling event, but I remember being absolutely devastated. I still contend to this day, Jim Neidhart did not give up to that Boston crap.
I don't know. It looked pretty good to me.
Yeah, it looked pretty good to you. Well, you have the tape to prove it, so I'll trust you. Now, but it was a real big disappointment, and I never liked the Harts then when they became faces, and, you know, just I'm getting upset about it now. I've never liked seeing a championship on a performer, you know, and I know this is, you know, it's a business. I'm not stupid. I know how this works, but It was really, really important. And when Beth won the women's championship in April, I was pretty emotional about that. And then, of course, she got injured to kind of cut that short. But that being that the age that I was and how much I loved the pink and black, and it was a big, big deal at the time.
Okay, yeah, and for me, you know, I was just, you know, I've been, this is, you know, really when I was, you know, super into it, you know, the peak of my fandom here, and I was just, yeah, I mean, you know, even, you know, Jesse Ventura notes how rare it is to put the titles on the line on TV. I mean, just making that such a huge deal, and they, you know, I love the way this match has worked. I mean, they. So many cool, you know, double team spots where, you know, the Hearts cheat behind, you know, the ref's back as, you know, they're beating up Santana and, you know, Martel's trying to run in and trying to be desperately, you know, to get involved and just, you know, just how they're able to take advantage of it and like do it where it makes sense. It's just really great stuff.
Yeah. And the Hearts were so cool in my opinion, because they were different. The two of them were different. They had different styles. They brought, you know, they were complementary to each other, whereas the Killer Bees were the same. You know, the Rougeaus were the same. I mean, you know, and they were all great wrestlers too. But, you know, it was so cool to see a tag team, especially back then when tag team wrestling was really prevalent. You know, yeah. One guy was the tank and one guy was a technician. And like you just said, their ability to play the heel in that tag team role, I have not enjoyed any team as much since.
Yeah, I think that's one thing that's a little bit overlooked with them is, I mean, I think they're the greatest team of that had, you know, two very different types of wrestlers that I can think of, you know.
Right.
Yeah, and yeah, their versatility, you know, they could do all these types of matches. I mean, they could really work well with Demolition. I mean, obviously, you know, Brett could work well with anybody, but Neidhart, you know, doing the power stuff with Axe and Smash, and you know, but you know, Anvil could, you know. He could, you know, he was athletic. He could jump. He could run. You know, he really, you know, they, you know, that was they could just do so much and were so versatile. And yeah, I don't think they're. I mean, maybe because Brett just had such a tremendous singles career, maybe they're not as well remembered as they should be. You know, like, I mean, obviously the Midnight Express are, you know, remembered as a great tag team and deservedly so. But you know. Part of that, I think, is because, you know, neither, you know, Eaton or Lane had standout or, you know, even Condry, you know, had standout singles careers afterward. I mean, they kind of petered out a little bit after they were done. I mean, you know, they had a few years here and there, but they were not, you know, the one of the top, you know, 10 stars of the 90s like Brett was. And, you know, just having all these tremendous, you know, high profile main event matches.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think the Hart Foundation is a little bit, you know, a little bit remembered, but you know, I think Strikeforce was just such a tremendous. I mean, I think Santana and Martel had such charisma. You know, it just had such, you know, great mix together, and I think Martel was just, you know, the classic baby face of just being like, you know, his comebacks. You know, were just he would just get so fired up, and he would just, you know, go after the heels and just, you know, it was great stuff. He just brought so much energy in. And, you know, I know, you know, not that the model was bad by any means, but I thought that him being a heel just was kind of a waste. Maybe not a waste, but it was just, he was such a tremendous baby face that, you know, making him a heel always, you know, never really made that much sense to me. Maybe it was just, you know, cause I really personally liked him. And then when he turned heel, I was disappointed personally, but you know, I was about 10 or 11 at the time he turned heel. So, you know, I was still at the age where, you know, I was, you know, very much wrapped up in that. But, but yeah, I think Martel was just such a good, you know, and Santana was great too. I mean, they both were really good. You know, even if they were a little bit, you know, they were maybe a little more cookie cutter baby face than some other guys, but they just really, you know, I mean, they could work. I mean, these guys, I mean, this match, it's probably a 10-minute match, but they get a lot of stuff in. They tell a really good story and, you know, and, you know, finally, you know, after the Hearts had such a great run and, you know, beaten so many teams and cheated so much, you know, it's finally, you know, for, you know, 8-year-old Jason to, you know, to see this and to see, you know, Strikeforce finally win. It was just, you know, so happy moment for me, obviously different for you, but, you know, obviously you can appreciate just, you know, what tremendous, you know, how tremendous both teams were.
Oh yeah, yeah, and we talk about emotion, and you know these performers. That's first and foremost their job, right? Is to bring out emotion in the people watching them perform. And you know, you're saying how the Hearts, you know, they kept the sneaking, they would cheat, you know, and people got frustrated and irritated by that. I thought they were great. One of my favorite matches I ever saw live was at WrestleMania 4 when Strikeforce defended against Demolition. And I remember at the time, I mean, Demolition was like, oh my God, who are these guys? And they looked awesome in that black leather with the spikes and Strikeforce. I love their song. And to me, that match had everything. You know, the music was great. They had great looks. The teams were great. You know, I liked Fuji at ringside. That yeah. was one of my highlights of matches I've seen in person.
Yeah, Demolition ended up, when all was said and done, when I was a kid, Demolition actually ended up being my favorite team. And I, you know, still love them these days, and I think that they're tremendously underrated as well, and, you know, not really remembered as well as they should be. But yeah, you know, yeah, WWE, it just adds to such a great tag team division at that time. I mean, there were so many teams that could work and that, you know. And I've, you know, tag team wrestling was emphasized and meant something, and, you know, maybe it wasn't, you know, drawing a lot of money, but it was something where it was providing, you know, great context. I mean, if you're talking about like the Hogan matches as dessert, I mean, the, you know, the great workers were providing, you know, the you know, were providing the meal essentially, and, you know, were, you know, filling you up with, you know, great wrestling goodness. And then, you know, Hogan was, you know, was the great taste at the end, you know, so to speak.
Well, didn't Brett say that when the Bulldogs and Hearts were brought in, that, you know, they were tearing the house down, and they took some heat for that because, you know, Don Morocco couldn't follow it up. You know, I mean, it was like, how the hell do I go out and now wrestle Bob Orton for 5 minutes? You know, after you guys just put on a show like they've never seen.
Yeah. Well, I mean, yeah, I mean, there's, you know, there's obviously, yeah, that's, yeah, that's the thing. I mean, you know, that tag division was so strong, and especially the Hearts and Bulldogs really started it, and then some of the other teams, yeah, I think, you know, were catching up, or, you know, just obviously, I'm sure that, you know, when certain teams are having great matches, you know, certain sense of professional pride, you want to have great matches too. I mean, I'm sure, you know, it's an infectious attitude, you know, so, you know, you had a lot of great teams and a lot of great combinations, just, you know, having wonderful matches, and, you know, luckily we, you know, you have YouTube these days, and, you know, you have DVDs where, you know, a lot of stuff has been preserved.
Mm-hmm.
So the last match we want to talk about is also from 87, from Saturday Night's Main Event, October 3rd, 1987. Honky Tonk Man against Randy Savage, and Honky Tonk is the Intercontinental Champion, and The Madness Meets the Mania. This is subtitled. So what made you pick this match?
Yeah, I wrote a column actually about this match because to me it's the only perfect match I've ever seen, and I came up with a criteria what that meant for me, and it had everything. First of all, I was there because it was at Hershey Park Arena, and there was a real palpable sense of anticipation for this match that I'm not sure exists much anymore, you know, in today's wrestling world. It's just different storytelling. But when Savage and Honky finally got in the ring that night, it was just sensational. I thought they had great chemistry together in the ring. You know, if you remember the match, Jimmy Hart gets knocked out, the Hearts come out, and then there's the beatdown at the end where Honky Tonk Man pushes Miss Elizabeth to the canvas.
Yeah.
And we talked about her a little bit earlier. I'll tell you this, honest to God, I've heard three times in my life I've been to wrestling shows when the crowd has just gone crazy. The ones was The Undertaker, HBK, we talked about WrestleMania 25. The second was when Hulk Hogan beat Randy Savage at WrestleMania 5 in the main event. I thought the roof was going to come off, literally. That's an old expression, I guess, but I really did think that. And when Honky Tonk Man pushed Miss Elizabeth to the canvas, I swear to God, it was like a riot in the Hershey Park Arena. It was like, you know, Liverpool soccer fans were watching and throwing beer and batteries. It was absolutely crazy. And the fact that, you know, she could generate this kind of emotion, this kind of pathos from the crowd, was just unbelievable. It's still unbelievable to me how much she was beloved. I think she gets a little bit pushed to the side historically for a couple of reasons. First of all, like you said, she didn't wrestle. You know, she didn't fit the modern day diva like Trish, who got in the ring, or like Sherry, who was great at doing everything.
Yeah.
Secondly, I think the fact that came out that she was actually married to Randy, they had the divorce, and some things about her personal life hurt her relationship with Lex Luger. And thirdly, I think her comeback in WCW did not go well. And I think it diminished, you know, she came back with like a little sexier look in the black leather, the NWO. And it was just, to me, hurtful to her legacy. In the storytelling they did, though, basically from 86 to 90 with her, though, that's hard to top. And I thought, you know, that match in 87, when we finally got Savage in the ring, I can quote you every single promo from the match before the show, the interview, you know, when they do the opening music and everything, the interviews before the match, the whole thing with Vince McMahon's commentary where, you know, we could be seeing a meeting of the madness and the mania, and, you know, we've just witnessed a historic event in sports entertainment. It was just unbelievable. The whole thing wrapped up. And don't forget, since I saw it live, I didn't see it with that commercial interruption. You see it on TV, they broke it up.
Yeah,
because it was on tape. In fact, they taped it, I think, on a Wednesday night, and they showed it a 10 days later on the Saturday Night Main Event. Mm-hmm. But it was just unlike any match I'd seen before since.
Yeah, and for people who don't know, this is the first time that Hogan and Savage shook hands. Savage had just turned babyface a few months earlier, was chasing after Honky Tonk, who was the Intercontinental Champion, as we said. And, you know, as you said, Jimmy Hart gets knocked out, so the Hart Foundation comes out, and then they interfere when Savage has Honky pinned for the DQ. They all beat up Savage. Elizabeth tries to get involved, but then Honky shoves her out of the way. Then she leaves the ring, goes to the back, and brings out Hogan. And then Hogan pauses for a second, then goes in, and then the soon-to-be Mega Powers fend off the heels. And which, interestingly, was they even point out that all four champions were in the ring at the same time. Tag champions, the Intercontinental Champion, and the World Champion, and which, you know, was incredibly rare that day, and it was an incredibly noteworthy thing. And of course today, you know, it's hard to even remember who the champions are sometimes. But then that moment when, you know, Savage sticks out his hand and Hogan shakes it, and these, you know, these two forces, you know, come together. It's really something.
And everybody's super serious in the danger zone. I mean, Savage, I mean, whether you like Macho Man or not, if you can name two guys that were ever better in interviews than him, I'd like to hear it, because I thought he was just sensational. And that night, I thought it was like his Hall of Fame resume that night.
Absolutely. I mean, everything. Yeah, this match is wonderful. Savage just Savage was an incredible performer. And I think the one thing that Savage isn't remembered for is his versatility. I mean, he could be a madman. He could be, you know, he could be a sympathetic babyface. He could be, you know, cocky, arrogant. He could basically play almost any character that you would want, any archetype that you would want in professional wrestling, he could pull off.
Oh, I agree. And, you know, I don't know, as I've heard the story go, then remember on the main event when Hogan and Andre had the rematch two Dave Hebners, of course, that if I'm not mistaken, Savage was supposed to win the Intercontinental title that night.
Yeah. And Honky refused to lose the Intercontinental title. I've heard him tell this story, and I've heard DiBiase tell the story a bit. You know, because obviously DiBiase was promised the WWF title, and it was going to win it at that tournament. And then because Savage did not win the Intercontinental title, he was given the world title instead. Yeah, I believe the story's, you know, been confirmed by Dave Meltzer, and I've heard it basically from DiBiase and Honky as well. So yeah, I'm pretty confident that is correct.
And what's crazy about that story to me is that's why WrestleMania 5 was back at the Trump Plaza, right? Because didn't they book it where like DiBiase was going to win it for, and you know, he had this big, you know, million-dollar man persona, and he only wrestled at, you know, million-dollar type places, and so they booked, you know, Trump for WrestleMania 5, and then it didn't have the same kind of punch, right? It was supposed to be part of the story.
Oh yeah, I actually didn't realize that. That's interesting. That made it, obviously it makes sense. But yeah, I hadn't heard that. Yeah, I think one thing, the crowd at 5 in particular, I don't know, the Trump Plaza was not necessarily the best atmosphere for wrestling. I mean, obviously you were there. Although I'm sure, you know, you were young. I don't know how well you remember how the crowd felt. But you know, throughout, especially that 5 show, I mean, there's definitely periods where they do not seem into it at all. And it's sometimes it's hard to tell when you're watching a videotape versus when you're there. You know, the recording isn't always the strongest or whatever, but.
Well, no, I think you're right. I mean, this show was not a great show. You know, as much as I'd like to say, boy, I thought it was the greatest WrestleMania of all time, it certainly isn't. You know, the Hogan Savage match is a fantastic match, a culmination of a great storyline. You know, you can take or leave a lot of the other matches on the card. I thought that the Warrior Ravishing Rick Rude match holds up.
Yeah, the Strike but, Force and Brainbusters match I think is pretty strong too.
Yeah, and it's good storytelling, right?
Yeah.
You know, although I tell you this, I was a little shaken up because after the show was over, my buddy and I went back to the Trump Plaza. We're walking around, and you know, we're just kind of taking it all in. And Rick Martel and Tito Santana walk in with Vince McMahon, and I'm like, wait a minute. You know, what's going on here? You know, again, I just hadn't been clued in. And then we look over and the Bushwhackers are eating like a nice steak dinner with their wives. Like, what, what's going on here?
That's interesting. That's funny.
That kind of stuff shakes you up when you're a kid. It's like when Duggan and Sheik got caught on the New Jersey Turnpike, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know, I didn't hear that story until a lot later. So if I'd heard that when I was 8, I would have probably been pretty shaken up. Luckily, I didn't I don't remember exactly. I mean, when I was clued in exactly. I mean, I was pretty distraught when Hogan lost the title for the first time, and I cried when that happened in 88. I kind of figured out, I guess, sometime around that, you know, around when I was 9 or 10, or you know, or I was either told or I kind of slowly learned it. Of course, I didn't really understand how the business exactly, you know, how everything really worked, how it was done, and you know, until I was really, you know, late 90s when I kind of rediscovered wrestling, you know, through the internet.
Mm-hmm. Right, and you know, books started to be written that were much more informative. I gotta tell you, I couldn't learn a foreign language to save my life. I, you know, I couldn't count to 10 in Spanish if you gave me 4 years to learn how to do it. But you know, I just soak up everything, you know, the wrestling history like a sponge. I find it really, really fascinating because I feel like when I was a big fan growing up, it was a little bit like the Wizard of Oz. Like I couldn't see behind the curtain, and I took it all for what it was, you know. And then now to have the ability to go back and see a little bit more what it really was in terms of the business sense. I find that extremely, extremely interesting.
Definitely, definitely. Well, thanks a lot for doing the show. Why don't you go ahead and let everybody know where they can find you if they're interested in checking you out or finding out where they can find you.
Okay, very good. Well, like you had mentioned earlier, I write for a website called Diva Dirts or at Diva. -dirt.com, and we cover the full range of women's wrestling. I think you'll enjoy it if you go check it out. And I do host a radio show on that site, Diva Dirt Live. That's 10 p.m. on Wednesday evenings, so you can check that out and call in if you want to talk about what's going on in the world of women's wrestling, not just the WWE Divas. I also write a column called Hitting the Ropes that's published on there about 3-4 times a month. And you can find me on Twitter. It's DLB19338. That's DLB19338. And you can follow me on Twitter. And, you know, I'm not that interesting, but every now and again, I think something's funny, so I'll throw it up there.
Well, sounds great. Well, thanks a lot for doing the show. We really appreciate it. And if everyone can check, of course, visit us at WrestleSpective.com and see us on Twitter, twitter.com/WrestleSpective or facebook.com/WrestleSpective. And if you want to give us a email, just send it to WrestleSpective@gmail.com. And thanks a lot for listening, everybody, and we'll talk to you again.